Support for WOSU podcasts comes from listeners. You can give at WOSU.org. Thank you for supporting digital content from WOSU Public Media.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The high cost of higher ed and the debt that it brings to so many families, coupled with changes brought on by the pandemic, has altered the trajectory for many would-be college students. 11 months into the pandemic, most classes are still held online, with little change until perhaps next fall. An increasing number of students worry that degrees earned during the pandemic may be devalued by employers. They wonder, is higher ed worth the price, at least right now? We're talking about the affordability and practicality of attending college during the pandemic and the road ahead for colleges and universities responding to its challenges. Eric Kelderman is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's been covering the issue. Welcome to the show, Eric Kelderman.
Thanks. It's great to be with you. I appreciate it.
You know, unlike other financial crises like the 2008-2009 recession, the pandemic happened virtually overnight. How prepared was higher ed to weather the storm? What did we learn from that?
Well, probably no better prepared than a lot of other institutions, of course. It's a sort of an unprecedented crisis in terms of the public health, as well as, of course, the financial fallout. So I think higher ed did really as well as anybody could have expected. They quickly, as you know, pivoted to remote learning. Most colleges across the U.S. shut down their campuses, sent their students home, and said, we're going to finish the semester online. And then they spent the spring and the summer, in many cases, figuring out what they would do in the fall of 2020.
What do we know about drop-off from college because of the pandemic?
Surprisingly, only one, I would say, sector of higher education has really seen a significant decline in enrollment, and that is community colleges. And that's sort of odd because typically in economic downturns, we see community college enrollment go up. This time it was down something like, first-time students were down something like 20%. And mostly, of course, not surprisingly, among low-income and people of color. A lot of that, I think, from the folks that I talked to, has to do with a couple of reasons. One is, in previous economic downturns, you know, you might have a sort of second job to sustain you during college, even if it's not your dream job. That's been tougher. And of course, the childcare issue, I think, is really paramount for a lot of working adults who would have gone to community college to upskill during the downturn.
Yeah.
Other sectors of higher education, surprisingly, have done quite well. Selective institutions, even if they're online, have retained, I would say, the vast majority of their students. You know, so in that regard, it has not been a total disaster for higher education.
What about new students who are just going to start school last fall? I know only anecdotally someone who was going to start a grad program at Duke, put it off for a year because Duke allowed them to. Another kid I know dropped out because he just couldn't handle the remote learning and decided to just give up college altogether.
There has been some of that, but like I said, most of that's been at the community college level. We haven't seen huge, I would say, although, you know, the declines that have happened, I guess, have been largely among freshmen. But you have to remember, you know, what's the alternative for these young people, right? A gap year means what during the pandemic? What are you going to do? You're not going to travel to Europe and backpack, right, and stay in hostels. You're probably not going to have an easy time finding a job. Like I said, I mean, enrollment has been surprisingly strong. So for some students, a gap year is possible. I have seen anecdotally, alternatives for remote learning, which is like summer camp locales, right? Sleepaway camps that have been hosting, semester college students to go there and engage in, I guess, appropriately distanced activities, but and also pursue their studies online.
I want to talk about that decline in community colleges, because although it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, it affects so disproportionately people of color and low-income students. But before we do that, how have schools adapted their pandemic strategies since the start of the crisis?
Well, you know, I think what we saw was the vast majority of schools are doing either primarily or mostly remote learning or some hybrid of that, where they offer some in-person classes for things like science labs or things that are very difficult to do remotely. About a quarter of the schools are doing primarily in-person, including some big players like Purdue University, right? Some major universities. But they still offer, you can be on campus but still study primarily online. You could be in your dorm doing classes. So you get sort of a mix of both worlds. For the spring, what we've seen so far is that most colleges are sticking with what they did in the fall. Some are trying to increase their on-campus presence, but it's going to be difficult, of course, because we're just coming off of a huge wave of coronavirus cases across the country.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the impact of the pandemic on higher ed today. We kick it off with Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's go back to that on that enrollment at two-year colleges, down about 10% from what I understand from the previous fall. It's disproportionately low-income and students of color attend those colleges. So that's pretty significant. That's an issue, is it not?
Well, certainly for the students that would have gone, it's an issue.
Yeah.
And financially, of course, it has an impact on those colleges. Those are mostly going to be public colleges. And so they don't face entirely the same kinds of pressures, financial pressures that large public or private universities face, but certainly it's hard for them. It means layoffs. We have seen a significant amount of layoffs at colleges, universities across sectors because of lost revenue. So even though students are showing up, colleges across the board are losing money because of increased costs of operating for PPE, or they can't utilize their classroom space as much. So that's actually a cost, and they're losing money on room and board. But yeah, the two-year colleges will take a big hit this year financially. And of course, the students who would have otherwise gone and started on their degrees, that could have a very big impact on them.
Is there any sense that they're going to be lost, or can they be recovered?
That's going to be tough. I think, if you're in a family that has suffered sort of extreme financial hardship because of the pandemic, it may be years before you have the opportunity that you feel like you can afford to go back to college again. So for some of those students, certainly this will be a devastating life change. And it will depend a lot on what happens economically after, the vaccine becomes widespread and how much we can open up the economy again.
Bond rating agencies, Moody's Investor Service and Fitch Ratings, project college revenues declining 5 to 10% this year. You said layoffs are a big part, because personnel is always a big part of that. But long term, do you see, or have they worried, are they concerned about any kind of long term impacts to this?
I think the long term changes are going to be, it's really hard to say right now. And it depends on the institution. If you're a very wealthy private institution with a big endowment, you should be all right. Major public research universities, Ohio State, your hometown there. In general, there will be some consequences financially for them, but they will be able to weather the storm pretty well. I think the long-term changes that we'll see might actually be some good things, which is colleges moving to remote and sort of enhancing their remote instruction could make those courses more attractive and more accessible down the road. And so that's a big positive for a lot of students. Not every college or university is going to pursue that, but for some that could be a real game changer.
What about Congress? We have a Democrat-controlled Congress now, at least for the time being, narrowly controlled, more so in the House than it was before. And, you know, it's by the skin on their teeth in the Senate. But how does that factor into the higher ed equation at this point?
Well, Congress, of course, has a very limited ability to affect the individual, say, tuition prices, things like that at colleges. What has happened, as we have seen, is this $1.9 trillion coronavirus aid package is likely to move very quickly now through the House and the Senate. That will provide about $40 billion for higher education. About half of that will be distributed directly to students under the current terms of the bill. Those colleges have a wide variety of making that money available to students, but it also helps them in terms of, if they have to upgrade their technology, for instance, to provide remote courses or provide training to faculty or give better laptops to faculty webcams for home instruction, things like that. Buy PPE or outfit classrooms. So that'll be some relief for the institutions and for students as well.
And when you say getting money directly to the students, sorry to interrupt you, but do you mean indirect, just cash payment for students or through loans or grants or what?
Oh, no. All of the coronavirus aid packages have included some money for higher education, and about half of that money has gone directly to students. Now, like I said, colleges have different means for distributing that. Oftentimes it's in the form of sort of emergency financial aid, right? If you are a student living off campus and you're on your own financially and you don't have a job now and you can't pay your rent or your groceries, things like that. So they're not just handing out, most of them at least, are not just handing out $500 or $600 checks to everybody on campus. Uh-huh. They put it in a pot and they make students maybe apply for that money. Very often there's income criteria. So students who are low income and eligible for Pell Grants, for instance, the federal Pell Grant program, they're, I would say, more likely to get that money than, your average middle or upper middle class student.
Are the universities and colleges doing a good job of getting the information out to students? Listening to you and from reading about this, they must be doing a pretty good job, which accounts for the lack of drop off, at least at the big universities and that's kind of thing.
I think another maybe silver lining of the coronavirus is that colleges and universities have had to figure out new ways to engage potential students. So when I did some coverage on enrollment for the fall, I talked to a lot of enrollment vice presidents, and the virtual events that they were hosting for potential students, I think, turned out very well for the most part, and in fact, made it possible for some students who might not have been able to visit the campus then to get more information. And so, communication with potential students and with parents, that has been really paramount for these institutions.
There's the question, and we're going to get into it later in the program, but I wanted to ask you, too, about employers devaluing a degree earned during the pandemic. Is there any sense about that?
I mean, we hear these things from surveys, from employer surveys, mm-hmm. right? There's a group called the AACNU that puts out a survey every couple of years that talks about what employers want. And typically it's soft skills, so-called soft skills, right? Communication, teamwork, independent thinking, stuff like that. I guess, on the other hand, employers keep asking for college degrees for, the majority of positions that are opening up. And certainly in a knowledge and information economy, a service economy, college degrees have become more important, at least as a signal to the employer that someone has completed an education. Whether they really need those skills or not is another question. But I keep saying this, you know, until Goldman Sachs starts hiring high school grads, it's a good idea to have a college degree, probably, right? We don't see big corporations putting out ads in high schools for high school graduates. So, right.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see, one quick question from a caller. Ruth in Columbus, you're on the air with Eric Kelderman of the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
So I read The Price You Pay for College, which came out 2 weeks ago, and Ron Lieber spent a lot of time talking about discounting. Can you talk to us about how a family, in your mind, should think about what college really costs because of the whole trend of discounting, meaning you get in, but that's not really the tuition. You may get a discount, which could be called as merit aid. It's not really financial aid. Just as a parent of a junior, I'm digging into this and I'm pretty confused about how to think about it.
Yeah, it's kind of like buying a car or something, even a used car. I mean, it is squishy. Eric Kelderman?
It is very confusing, of course. And what the caller is talking about, for those who might not be familiar with, is generally if you apply to a particular private college, they might have a $40,000 price tag, right?
For sticker price kind of thing.
Sticker price type of thing. And then what they do is they offer some students what they call a merit aid package. It is essentially financial aid. It's meant to entice you. And then, of course, the lower you are, the less money your family makes, probably the more aid you may get. What they're hoping to do is, of course, balance out their class where they get a bunch of students who are able to pay more and a few students who are able to pay less. And so the aid fluctuates, right, by your income level. And that's how they build their class, right, around the sort of a financial profile as well as other metrics, right, geographic and diversity and other forms, economic and racial diversity. And it makes it hard for tough. I mean, hard for parents. I have two kids who went to college, and one ended up at a private school where this happened, and one ended up at the University of Maryland, which is good. So less price tag overall. But in terms of looking at for parents, I think what you need to do is wait till you see what the financial aid package is. And then you're going to have to crunch some numbers in terms of, look at your total expenses, which colleges aren't always great at including, right? Books, incidental costs of living on or off campus. And then think about, is it worth, the loan money that I'm going to have to take out maybe to cover that gap in the long run? And for a lot of students, For middle class and upper middle class students, if you borrow $30,000 to go to college, for most of you it will pay off economically. That's the statistical data that we have. If you go to college but you can't afford it and you have to drop out without your degree and you've borrowed some money, that's a big problem. Then you're stuck with that debt and you don't have the diploma then to get that job that you were needing to pay off those loans.
Eric Kelderman, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was great being with you. I was happy to do it. Thanks.
Eric Kelderman is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We will continue to discuss the economics, the pandemic, and so forth, and the impact on higher ed. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how colleges and universities are responding to the challenges brought by the pandemic. Among them, convincing students that the college experience is still worth the cost, even when so many classes and other functions are remote. Pete Van Leer is a research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio. That's a liberal-leaning think tank. Welcome back, Pete.
Thank you, Ann.
Jim Thrasher is the senior advisor to the vice president for student recruitment at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He recently wrote an article for the school's Institute for Faith and Freedom titled "The Moral Dimensions of the Student Loan Crisis." Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Pleased to be with you.
Jim Thrasher, I want to get to the point of your article in a bit. But first, could you tell us about the adjustments Grove City College, you know, tell us where Grove City College is and what you've done to adjust to the pandemic?
Well, we have a great course medical team that's directing all of our procedures, policies on campus. We had a very successful in-class semester last semester. We're starting out really great this semester as well. So we have students who are really participating, working well in regard to the policies and procedures. We're a family, a community here at Grove City. We want to be together. We're taking the necessary steps to make sure that we can do that. And so great semester last semester. Matter of fact, we had a wonderful admission season in regard to bringing prospective families to the campus. And so we're off to a great start again this semester.
It feels like, you know, I went to did a pretty classic liberal arts education at a Big Ten university. It doesn't sound great to go to college right now, Jim Thrasher, have the remote learning. I liked going to class. I liked everything about what it used to be like.
Right. I think that, you know, I'll be candid with you, Anna. And of course, I'm a faculty member here at Grove City. I learned more out of the classroom than I did in the classroom in regard to my opportunities for leadership, the dorm life, appreciating one another and backgrounds and experiences. I grew like a weed. So we really believe here at Grove City that community and that family and being together is really important. We left the campus the middle of March last year. It was very apparent by our communication with our students that they were yearning to be back together. And so we have done that, and it's been a very good thing.
All right. So let's talk about the question of affordability and the practicality of attending college, particularly during this unusual time. I mean, what are you hearing from students? What are their concerns?
Well, and as I wrote in the op-ed, I mean, it's a challenge to find the money to go to college today. The average amount of money spent, of course, on a college education bachelor's degree is $140,000. So most students do not have that and are turning to student loans. So I certainly a real challenge financially for students to make sure that they have the money to go to college. I think there's a real responsibility though for those students to have individual responsibility when it comes to where they attend, the process that they go through in regard to selecting loans and realizing how much they want to take on in regard to loan debt, selection of college in regard to fit. One of the things that I cover in my article is the whole role. I was the director of career services here at Grove City College for 23 years of a nationally ranked career services program. So the role or course of a college not only to bring students in, but also to launch them. So for students to take responsibility when it comes to selecting a major, internships, being involved in their career services office. An interesting statistic for you, Anne, is that 69% of college graduates have either never been in their career services office or visited once or twice. It's no wonder that our students are coming out of college with no direction. So there's lots of pieces to that puzzle.
Pete Van Leer, what about this moral issue how do you see this playing out when it comes to taking on more debt than you can afford and not understanding what that means?
Well, so I think that's a really good question, but I would take a different approach to it, because if you look in Ohio, 77% of higher ed students are attending public institutions, right? So unlike Grove City College. I mean, we have some very good private schools in Ohio, but really the system, if you look at the systems level, what we see is an underfunding of public ed. We've sort of stopped looking at public education, higher education included, as a public good. And we've kind of, we are reducing funding across the board, across the country, really, including in Ohio, that public support, our taxpayer dollars are being used differently, and including for tax breaks and things like that. So I think we're really underfunding public ed and not supporting students. And in public institutions, if you cut public funding, you raise tuition. There's no other way to do it. So that's really the issue here in Ohio.
A lot of times it's just explained as the cost of higher education is going up. All things being equal, of course, the cost is going up, relatively speaking, with inflation and whatnot. But you're saying that, no, the funding is changing. The funding of public education is changing more than the cost going up.
Yeah, I think that's a really key piece of this puzzle. If you look in Ohio, lawmakers spend nearly $10 billion a year on special interest tax breaks that really haven't done anything to grow our economy. But over all that time, they haven't done enough to fund schools. If you look at the state support, it's been falling or flat for more than a decade. And I think that's really where the issue is. You know, if you can't fund the schools from the public schools, we talked about community colleges. You know, the reporter from the Chronicle was talking about community colleges being hit the hardest right now.
Yeah.
And that's very true. And if you look in Ohio, there's the Ohio College Opportunity Grant, which is not accessible to community college students because of how it's structured. Mm-hmm. They weren't even able to spend the money that they allocated before the pandemic because of the structural flaw. You're not reaching the lowest income students attending the most affordable schools. So those are examples of really a systems level thing. I mean, sure, I think students and their families need to be very focused on what they can afford and not take on too much debt. But we have this system right now of lack of public funding, lack of public support for lowest income students, especially Black and Brown students. And then at the same time, you have this sort of debt industry that thrives on, you know, why do we have student loans? Is it to support a collections industry, a servicing industry, or is it to really support students and get them the education that will strengthen our communities and our state as a whole? So I think those are the questions for me looking at a policy systems level. It's really important to do that.
And there's another issue I want to talk about with you, Pete Van Leer, and that is how Ohio manages student debt collections from its public universities and colleges. But first, Ohio's kind of unusual on that score, and it's really important. But Jim Thrasher, I wanted to talk about in your article, you lay out the issue of marketing measures and admissions policies that many schools employ to attract students, and that they de-emphasize the cost and they kind of oversimplify what it's going to take. What do you mean by that?
Well, I really, in the article, Anne, identify really four players, I think, in this moral issue. First, of course, is colleges. Second of all, certainly I identify lenders. Thirdly, career services offices. And then lastly, I think individual responsibility for students to understand what this is all about and really taking charge of their financial futures. But on the private side, a lot of colleges have overspent, tapped endowment funds, paid exorbitant salaries, carried over deferred maintenance, and actually they're paying off their own loans. So prospective students have a target on their back. They're literally the bank for overextended institutions. So yeah, I would say that many private colleges have questionable marketing measures and admissions policies, and actually have adopted scholarships created falsely to lure students to their campuses. What I'm speaking about specifically, Anne, is what's called discounting. And let me just do it in real numbers for you and your listeners. Say X college understands that room, board, and tuition is actual dollars, $30,000 to bring that student to the campus for for two semesters. They actually inflate their price to $50,000. The cost that they list per year is $50,000. So what it does is it literally establishes $20,000 of what I call monopoly money, poof money, money that doesn't exist. And they use that then to provide scholarships for students. And of course, it's ingenuous, it's not real. Also, what's interesting is, say John gets a $10,000 scholarship and pays $40,000 a year, realize that now that college has $10,000 above cost that they can either then give to another student. In other words, then John's family is actually paying to have someone else come to the campus, or they can just put it in their coffers. So discounting is a very, very interesting thing to think about, and for prospective students to know that that's going on.
So Pete, let's talk about the role of student debt collections once the debt is incurred. Now, it doesn't apply to necessarily private schools, right? Although it could be, could it in some cases apply to students who attended private schools? And how does it work in Ohio?
So there's a couple, for starters, you know, there's the student loan debt, which is not held by the schools themselves. It's not money owed directly to schools, which is a different issue, but a very important piece of this puzzle as well, mm-hmm. as we're already talking about. The Ohio-specific issue here is institutional student debt, and it's really set up in Ohio law around public schools, public colleges and universities. And so those schools are required to turn debt over to the Attorney General's Office for Collection in Ohio. It's one of only five states around the country that requires this. And it's a pretty rigid punitive system where, you know, the law says within 45 days of incurring the debt or 10 days after the next semester, that debt has to be turned over to the Attorney General. The Attorney General then makes an effort to collect on that debt. They add fees, fines, interest to it. And if the Attorney General doesn't collect, then goes to a third party for 270 days. And it's just this whole process that ends up at going to a special counsel where they pursue, you know, lawsuit, you know, suing former students for the debt. And it's connected to transcript withholding. So schools generally won't release official transcripts. If you want to go to a different school or get a better job that requires you to show a transcript, you're kind of stuck. So it's just really a good example of Ohio's punitive approach that's yet another barrier to creating more affordable, accessible college, post-secondary education.
In other states that are less punitive, do they collect debt at about the same rate, or is there a difference, a distinction there?
Well, there are some differences. I mean, there are a number of states that do allow, like Ohio, 27 states allow the states to collect, to claim students' tax returns, for example, state tax returns as a way to collect right. on that debt. But the rest of the states do not. And often they will leave it to the schools themselves to figure out how they're going to go about this, how they're going to collect the debt. And there's some examples in Ohio and for example, in Michigan, there's a nationally known example where they have a debt forgiveness program where they bring students back and say, look, if you come back, we will forgive your debt over a period of time and allow you to get your degree that you were trying to get in the first place. We'll provide more support. And what's interesting is they found that when they do these kinds of programs and do them carefully and thoughtfully, their return on investment for the schools is actually higher. They get more money in new tuition from that student because that student often has access to financial aid from like a Pell Grant. Mm-hmm. And so more revenue comes to that school to support the school. And then you get the student finishes their degree. So it's a win all around. It's like, it really is a better way of approaching that issue. And Ohio's current law is kind of getting in the way of that. And we're working on trying to change that.
And Jim Thrasher, real quick, I mean, can you explain how it works in Pennsylvania? I mean, what if a student has debt at your university? What happens?
You know, I don't work on the financial aid side at all, and I'm sorry, I really can't answer that question.
All right, well, Jim Thrasher, senior advisor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Nice to be with you, Anne. Thank you.
You bet. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about college affordability and practicality during the pandemic, how colleges and universities are responding to the challenges of COVID-19, and kind of particularly focused on how public colleges and universities are responding to the financial challenges. Still with us, Pete Van Leer. He's research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio. That's a liberal-leaning think tank. And joining us is Greg Lawson. He's a research fellow at the Buckeye Institute. That's a conservative think tank. Welcome back, Greg.
Glad to be on.
So what are your thoughts about this? Are students, college students in Ohio, getting enough bang for their buck right now?
I think there's a real question whether students across the nation are getting the right kind of bang for their buck. I think that, one of the things that we've started to really try to work on here, and I think is something that the state has already moved towards, is realizing that the four-year degrees in universities are very, they're very expensive. They're not always translatable right out of the gate to jobs and income. And so you're saddling with a lot of these students with debt. And obviously that's the big problem. You've got tons of issues with family, people not being able to start families, buy houses, things like that, because they've got all this debt. Well, that's clearly an unsustainable status quo that doesn't work. I think that there is some discussion about what is the right amount of subsidy that happens. And I think that is probably predominantly federal is going to make the biggest difference, but the state certainly has its various subsidies through the state share of instruction and through the OCOG grant, which goes to the underprivileged students. But I think we also have to look at, are we funneling students into the right location? How much can we do for community colleges? How much do we need to do towards certification programs where people are in high school and maybe go to a technical school or go to a community college and get some of their credits while they're still in high school? How do we get them into jobs that way with limited exposure necessarily to going all the way to like a four-year university? I think that's where we need to start kind of recalibrating some of our approach to the whole higher education system. So we've got a real problem. So yes, I think students are not getting what they need really out of this. And I think it's unfortunate, but I think there's a whole host of things that we need to do. I'll also mention that I think that there's a lot of administrative costs in universities that have helped to build out. You can see that administrative costs grow faster than teacher costs and professor costs. That's a problem that needs to be addressed as well.
When you say administrative costs, you mean like when you build a giant new union, you have to have somebody to run it too?
Well, that's part of it. And there's a lot of, there's research universities, you've got grant writers, you've got a lot of different things like that. And some of that is necessary. I'm not saying that you're never going to have any administrators at all, but there's a lot of numbers that would indicate that what you see in the education space, and it's true in higher ed, it's also kind of true in K-12, is you see a much higher number of increase in administrators over the last 20 to 30 years or so that is taking resources. And the question is, are we directing money into the classroom? Are we directing money into direct professors and folks that are gonna be imparting the knowledge that the students are actually paying for? Or are there all these back room kind of folks? Some of them may be necessary, but universities are gonna have to really look very hard at that. They can't just come to the state and say, give us more money to pay for that. Hmm.
What about what Pete Van Leer was talking about earlier about Ohio's system of debt collection and how that is hurting itself going forward?
I think that we have to be careful about what we do with debt. The Buckeye Institute would say that you can't just absolve people of debt because that creates a whole host of issues. That said, I do think that there are some ways that we can elongate debt timeframes and we can be reasonable with students. We can look at some of the interest rates that we're charging. And I think probably one of the other issues is the timeframe we have when we certify things like the state attorney general and the timeframe we have there. And then what is the process by which the attorney general goes to the debt collection entities? I think that we are fairly punitive in that sense. And I think that there is some room for us to have some more grace, frankly, with a lot of these students. But I think we also have to be careful and realize that we need to get the cost down so that we limit the debt that students are incurring on the front end, but we can't just wave a magic wand and get rid of the debt. So we're going to have to balance some of the grace with also being able to change the underlying cost structure.
So, Pete Van Leer, what about that? Working on both sides of the equation.
Sure. Yeah, I think Greg's points about really how do we get the cost down? I think that's really important. And but it's all, I think my emphasis would be on how do we get the cost down for the students, you know, so people can afford it. And you can get in. Yeah, I think if you look around at the schools in Ohio where there's been layoffs, I think professors, you know, like the teachers have been up in arms saying, you know, we need to focus on the classroom. And I could not agree more. And I think that's part of what Greg is saying. So I think how do we make sure that our schools are doing what students need? And often when we think about college, we think 4 year. And I think Greg has a good point. You know, it's like it's 2 years. It's the credentials. It's what people need and finding out what they need. And how do we make that affordable, accessible? And right now, you know, the community college drop in enrollment is a pretty clear example of where the state and, you know, if the Biden administration and Congress passes the package they're talking about, as the Chronicle reporter said, $40 billion for higher ed. And I think that's hugely important in this moment to get through this crisis. And it's a start. It's like we have to start looking at how do we make sure that the students who really need this can access the education they want. And what's clear right now, particularly with the need-based aid in Ohio, the Ohio College Opportunity Grant, community college students, for example, are not even able to access
that. No, I thought they were trying to work on that to change that so that community colleges would have access to it, but that hasn't happened.
That has not happened. I think that would be a great change. Looking at this, what I said before about how there was money that went unused, that just points to the structural problem.
Yeah.
And if you really want to help those students who are getting a credential or a 2-year degree, maybe even moving into, you know, strengthening the transition from 2 to 4 if they are successful at the 2-year. But looking at that, changing OCOG to make it better, particularly for Black and Brown and low-income students, that's going to be huge. Ohio has a goal of 65% of all adults aged 25 to 64 are going to have some kind of workplace credential or degree within 5 years, 4 years now. And we're never going to make it unless we start looking at how do we help restructure that aid and make sure more students, adult learners included, can get either into or back into school to get the education they need to compete, to get those jobs that we know require something beyond high school now.
Yeah, you know, Greg Lawson, that number, the drop in attendance at public 2-year colleges, down about 10% from the previous fall, directly related to the pandemic. And it really laid bare a lot of the problems that students at community colleges, the community colleges tend to attract, face, which is childcare, they're working other jobs, that kind of a thing, and they just couldn't hold it together. What about that?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing is, I think Pete brings up a great point about using the opportunity grant and being able to structure it in such a way so that funding should go to these locations. I mean, I think, I don't want to be overly negative, but I'll be kind of blunt about this. I think we spend way too much money on 4-year universities in Ohio, and we have kind of shortchanged the community colleges. And what we're finding is the community colleges are where a lot of folks are going to get their foot in the door, possibly then go to a 4-year after they maybe get an associate's degree or get their first complete. In fact, a lot of times you can get your general education credits at a much lower cost that then translates
right
and transfers. So why aren't we trying to get folks to do that? We need to be doing that, and we need the opportunity grant to be able to do that. I'll say, too, another thing. So I think that funding there, whether we increase the pot or we divvy up the same pot that we're spending now, I'm going to be really blunt. We need to get more money into the community colleges where it's going to help the most people who need it now to get the kind of credentials they need. Oh, I'm an Ohio State graduate. I love Ohio State. I love the Ohio State Buckeye football team. I love the campus. I love everything about it. I think they get more money than they need, frankly, from the state. And I think we should be shifting some of the funding to some of the 2-year community colleges so that we can address the kind of folks, and again, non-traditional students. You've got adult, to the point that both of you raised, you've got a lot of working parents, working mothers who are struggling to do that. they're not going to be going to the four-year place, at least not out of the chute a lot of times. That's where the community colleges fit in, and we are not doing enough to address that.
We're kind of running out of time, and I'm really interested in your thoughts about how the pandemic and the response to the pandemic at the four-year and at the two-year level, what we've learned from it going forward, how it could change for the better education. Pete Van Leer?
Well, I think, we have to think about the students and see what the schools need to be thinking about how they can best serve their students and what they provide and what's essential. I would push back a little bit on Greg. I'm not sure we want to be reducing funding for the 4 years necessarily. As I mentioned before, you know, we've got $10 billion a year almost in tax cuts and loopholes in the state. We've lost all this money that could be going into things like higher ed. So I don't think it's a take from Paul to pay Peter or whatever it is. But it really, we need to think about, where can the money be best spent? How can we find the revenue? And then, encourage and work with schools to think about how they best serve students. And we talked about the transfer, for example, from 2 to 4 year. Make sure those transfers are as easy as possible. There are relationships that are happening. There are 2 years that are providing 4 year degrees now. There's a pilot of that in Ohio. Those are kinds of things that we can really look at to make sure that we have equity, that everybody is getting what they need, and that Ohio, as a result, will become a stronger state with a better economy. But it takes resources. We can't just say, well, we don't have any money, because the money is there. We're leaving it in the wrong places. We're cutting income taxes for higher income Ohioans over the past decade or 15 years at the expense of the strength and the vitality of our state.
And Greg Lawson, real quick, I mean, what is your understanding about the objections to extending something like the opportunity grant to students at two-year institutions at community colleges? What's the hang up here?
You know, I will be candid. I'm not 100% sure. And I'll venture to say that whatever they are, if there are some legitimate points that need to be worked through, there are ways to do that. But I don't think that the underlying concept, you can find anything flawed with that at all. And I think that's something we need to, there may be some concern about the overall funding, I suppose, question. And that could be an issue, but we need to get moving beyond that. Two other quick things. I'll mention that broadband is going to be really important so that we can
expand
this. There's a lot of movement on that in the governor's budget and some legislation that's moving. We actually are supportive of those concepts because the spending there, because that's the backbone for a lot of stuff. And the other thing is, I'll just point out industry partnerships and working with industry to then find where they work in consortiums to work with community colleges to develop curricula that work for the kind of employees that they know they need to recruit, and maybe they're having a hard time recruiting now. That's an alternative method, leveraging usually two-year community colleges as well. I think in the post-pandemic age, we're going to be needing to see much more of those kind of public-private partnership type things, so that we can target the resources. Because even if you do more resources, as Pete was saying, we do need to be careful how we're doing it. I think one of the great problems we've had historically is we haven't spent maybe as wisely as we should. Some people get frustrated with that, then they don't want to spend anything because they're thinking that they're throwing bad money away or money after something that they shouldn't be. We need to be able to target it correctly. And I think we're just at the beginning of really doing that.
Yeah, Pete, we've got about 25 seconds.
Yeah, just a real quick point on the opportunity grant. Part of the pushback and part of the resistance, I think, has to do with for-profit proprietary schools. They get a lot more money because they're more expensive. And the research shows that they don't serve their students well at all in terms of outcomes. So I think those schools are eligible. Their students are eligible for OCOG, for the opportunity grant. And I think that's one clear way to push them out to create opportunity for the 2 years.
And they oppose the 2 years, or?
I would imagine they do. Yeah, okay. There's a lot of money. They maximize their students' financial aid as much as they can.
Well, as usual, this is a conversation that could go on and on and on. There are so many pieces to this puzzle, but we will have to end it here. Pete Van Leer, research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on. Good to be here.
And Greg Lawson, research fellow at the Buckeye Institute. Greg, thanks for your time as well. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Always wonderful. Thank you.
You bet. Take care. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.